You're listening to Tokyo Public Radio. I was in Philadelphia a couple months ago, and I was there to meet a collaborator. He was at UPenn for a couple months, and things weren't going so well in our work together. So I took the train down, and we met, and it was a great meeting. We sort of felt very superior to everyone as we walked out into the streets, and we went over to a bar, and, you know, one of these bars that you get in a town that's not New York, sort of a, you know, nice wine bar. And he breaks out his MacBook Air, and he's showing me how he uses mind mapping software. And so, okay, I'd heard this phrase before, but I had never, you know, seen it actually in use by somebody who, you know, I could say had a mind. So it turns out, and I began to see this over the next couple months, is that all my genius friends were using mind mapping software. And if you're not using mind mapping software, you may want to ask yourself, am I a genius? Mind mapping software, it's, okay, so in the past, you read a book and you thought about it and you took some notes. And then later you'd maybe look at these notes and you would write something more. And then, you know, one day you'd write a book, say, or you do some homework. So that's very thinking 1.0. And thinking 2.0 is that you're the needle on the record, and the mind mapping software is the amplifier. Okay, so without the mind mapping software, you're just this tiny little vibrating needle. You're useless, you can't do anything. But when coupled with this program, and what it does is it assembles your notes, and you sort of tag things, you label different parts of your notes, you're putting information into this, and you're doing this, you're not a librarian, right? This is not a Dewey Decimal kind of thing. It's more like this improvisational jazz, and you're just generating semantic units. And the mind mapping software is sewing them together, right? So you have essentially outsourced, you've offloaded everything about yourself that is not meaningful, right? You're sending everything that we used to think was the job of somebody who thought things, and that's all of us. And you're now reduced to this sort of glowing transcendental subjecthood. It's really quite beautiful. I'm looking at a photograph of David Foster Wallace, and it's been somewhat processed. So, in fact, it looks like you've just turned on your Macintosh, and it's 1993, and somehow, you know, you have one of those extensions, and instead of the usual thing that comes up, it's this rendered one bit black and white, heavily pixelated image. The pixels are sort of just below the resolution of your eye. It's the HyperCard stack picture of David Foster Wallace. And if there's anyone who's got some hook into what mind mapping is, it's Wallace. Because Wallace was somebody who just recorded things. Infinite jest is practically infinite in not just the text, right? So the joke is, David Foster Wallace, this book is so long. Oh my God, like, I hate reading. How can I do this? But no, within the book, there are all these other books, and there are these lists and sort of discographies and all these stories that you get the feeling that he would have put in if he, you know, had enough time. And in fact, so there's this story, right, that apparently Infinite Jest was twice as long as the published version. And, you know, Jesus Christ, I really want that original copy, okay? But the bet that Infinite Jest made is the same bet, I think, that mind mapping makes, which is, I'm going to be as good as I can be. I'm going to be a thinker. I'm going to be as authentic as possible. I'm not going to lie. If there's something that doesn't fit my theory, I'm going to put it in. I'm going to write it down. And, you know, if they come in and they subpoena my books, they'll see all of my sins. And somehow, as long as I just sort of glow strongly enough, I will assemble something of value. And I don't mean that about the book itself. I mean somehow the back projection of the book's bet, because the book itself is it's a well-wrought book. I think the book was, I imagine, written the way books are always written. I don't think Wallace was sort of one of these obsessive corkboard type people. But the characters in this book are doing this kind of thing. They're hoping that something, okay, and maybe it's a computer, right? Something is going to put things back together. They can no longer be ordinary people, because ordinary people have already existed, they've lived, and there's not really, we can't really compete with them, right? We can't fall in love and write, you know, lyric poetry the way they did. And at the same time, they don't want to make this other alternative bet, which is just it's one gigantic YouTube MTV collage. They're not willing to dissolve themselves and sort of ooze out into the world. So what's left, what hope is left, if you know that you can't go back? You must go forward. There's going to be some overload. And so there needs to be something to put it together, but no priest is going to put it together. So you have a machine. You're listening to National Public Radio and the BBC World Service here in Tokyo, broadcasting from the second floor of the MIT Student Center. Sometimes there are trucks in Tokyo, and they're these small pickup trucks with loudspeakers saying things in Japanese, and on the back of the truck there's always a broken television. I think they're either a cult or the political system here. Somehow this is how they get important information, but they're certainly not telling me. It turns out, actually, Tokyo is pretty Firefly. Everything is kind of falling apart, and there's random bits of the 23rd century. You'll be in this crappy cafe that's Pamplona levels of crappiness, and the toilet will have a computer. There are these gigantic birds that they're so big. They're crows, but there's probably a word for crow when it's like the size of your forearm. I sometimes worry, I mean, do they eat children in the park? I didn't see it happen. I was racially profiled in Shibuya, and they asked me a lot of questions about, you know, what I was doing in Japan. And, I mean, that's a long story. You know, we didn't have enough common language to express what I was doing here. They ran my bicycle license through the computer to make sure I hadn't stolen my bicycle. That's it for this week on Postcolonial Public Radio. On the plane to Tokyo, I was finishing up this book by David Lord Smale. And Smale is a historian, and he's writing about what he calls deep history. And so deep history is, what's the first page in your primary school textbook? The first page is everything that happened before you actually have to learn anything about what happened, because everything before was not history. It was just flocks of birds and herds of animals, and we were just another kind of animal, and maybe we didn't even look like the people that are the subjects of history. And so the first chunk of his book is this kind of quite fun list, catalog of all of the justifications from the last 200 years of mass education, of why can we start somewhere if that means cutting off everything that came before. And in this move that you learn as a graduate student. You know, what if that interface didn't exist? I remember when I was taking Russian history, and I think the beauty of this paragraph on the first page of the textbook was one of the reasons I took so many Russian history classes, was the book was talking about, you know, Russia sort of emerging from sort of barbarism and prehistorical state. And it said, civilization begins when a grain of wheat can multiply itself 7 times. And you can think about this. You're these kind of Neolithic savages wandering the plain. You're, you know, hitting things and drawing pictures and marrying other people and, or, you know, whatever the Neolithic version of that is, right? Dating other people. And you've got 6 grains of wheat, and it's climbing, and so now it's 6.5 and 6.7, and, you know, things are getting a little funny. You're approaching this critical point. These sort of islands of civilization are thrown up, and then they disappear again, and you say, what was that? And you get to 6.9, and these islands start cooking together. It's like bubbles in this cauldron. It's boiling. And then suddenly you hit 7.0, and there's this singularity. And on the other side, you're now at 7.1 grains of wheat per grain you plant. And you are now a historical subject. You have sublimed into the world of a subject being a person. And now you have a society, and it's worth talking about you. And so this is absolutely hilarious. If you're a historian, this story is absolutely hilarious. If you're a physicist, you know, it's actually sort of plausible that the emergence of the modern subject was a phase transition in some set of material conditions, and subjectivity is so different from the rest of nature that it probably is a discontinuous transition. I can't think of some process that would generate it that did not have some kind of shocking discontinuity.